Yeah. New Year in Berlin. Okay, let's just. I'm not going to talk for very long, as we need a break for lunch. But just want to give a bit of shape to what we're going to do, and as much as I can. It's just interesting listening to everybody, really, because this sense of focus that is in people, the sense of change, and in a way, really, that's what I want us to look at, not just this weekend, but in this part of the course, because there's something about accessing that deeper creative energy and owning it and expressing it in our world, which means dealing with good ideas. It means dealing with difficulty. And there's something about this, it of course brings us right into connection with our sense of identity. Who am I? And how do I express myself? And how do I get met by the world? It's interesting, you know, listening to everybody chanting their names and sort of, and the what was really interesting about it is the distinctiveness as you listened into the kind of field. There's this very, you could hear people's individual names at times, and then at times it was sort of, there's a sort of harmonic resonance where it's just one kind of field. So there's something about the connection between the individual and the collective that is also part of what we're looking at here. And in Hebrew, if you say your name, I am, so if I am Ian, the word is ani in Hebrew. And it's an interesting word, ani, because it's made up of the same three letters as the letter Ayin, the name Ayin, which is Aleph Yud Nun. And the Ayin is the sort of the ground of potential. It's a kind of a stillness, it's sometimes called the nothing, but it's a field of possibility. And if you just rearrange those letters slightly, where the letter Yud, which is in the middle of the word Ayin, comes out and becomes the last letter. Now Yud is the letter that's always to do with intention and will. So it's almost the sense of, as we declare our identity, we declare our will, we declare our kind of intention. And it's almost like we take that latent potential and start to express it. We start to move it into relationship with the world. And when you take that phrase, if I take I am Ian, so we then come into, so that intention of being Ian, having been from being nothing, from just being stillness and being undifferentiated, we become ourselves. Now Ian is this complex collection of images and ideas and history and intention and complicated levels of intentionality, right? So this is what Ian is. But Ian arises out of a ground of stillness. And a lot of what we're looking at in some ways in this work is how to relate the kind of the aspects of ourselves that are more formless to the places that are formed. And I'm not going to talk at length because the time is short, but I'm going to use these diagrams a bit, which we've used a lot in the course already, which just remind us of what happens to us when we start to do this work. So the diagram at the bottom is the bottom end of the Tree of Life, which really looks at the dynamic between the sort of the body, the mind, the feelings, and what I've called the presence of light, which is the deeper sense of self, the deeper sense of stillness. And in the middle, we've got the sense of the foundation of our being, the image of ourselves, which is also in relationship to the image of the world. Because the whole point about identity is always in relationship. So in this image of if I'm Ayin, if I'm in that place of stillness, I could be anything, right? There's ultimate potential there. Once I become Ian, I become in relationship with the universe that Ian knows, Ian experiences and responds to Ian in particular ways. and there's a huge history. So there's vast, a whole world comes into existence when we name ourselves and when we name anything else. And we could think in a way of this whole process of expression. You can look at it using the metaphors of speaking and naming. Because in a certain sense, here we are, here I am, and I can be quiet, but I have my voice. I may not be using my voice right now. I am using my voice right now, of course. But when I'm quiet, my voice is in potential, right? So my voice is, I have a particular way of speaking, making use of things, particular vocal range of that comes out of the shape that I am. But if I want to put my energy out into the world in whatever way, whether to bless the world or curse the world, to heal or to harm, then I have to move from that place of potential into action. So I start to use my voice, which means I start to speak. And to speak, I use words, but also to speak, I have to use my breath. So the words that I use come out of my store of images, my store of understanding, my collection. So these interesting, John talking about the lost words that are vanishing out of the culture, right? Because the word is the word holds the living image. So if I think of owl or acorns, or two of the words you used, if I name that, I bring something of the quality of owlishness and acornish into the world, and it touches us all, right? But in order to do that, of course, I have to have an implicit image, my own implicit image, my own name of owl and acorn. If I don't have the words owl and acorn, you know, there's an interesting anthropological study of Eskimos, who have, I think it's 35 different names for snow. Right. So they have a way of naming and expressing and understanding and relating to the world of snow that we don't, with our much more limited palette, we don't have. So they have and they of course have a wider range of creative expression around snow than we do. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the lost words ideas and the rather chilling idea of natural words vanishing and digital words appearing is the creative expression of people, if they have lost those words, is limited. So that instead of the potential, because in order for that potential of Ayin is infinite, but it has to come through the living form that is the human being, with the stores of words and images that can focus the light, focus the energy. And that whole thing that we keep looking at about icons and idols, so the in the pure creative expression, what happens is something arises from the still place that has an active, that is a living intention that connects to an image, and that image is an iconic image, it's a luminous image that conveys meaning and possibility, but connects us also with the deep well of potential. It takes us beyond the limitations of our own form, and in fact expands our own form. So the sense of being Ian or Becky or Ali or Pauline becomes expanded. Now, in a certain sense, the whole point of this work is to value our own form, to love it, but to constantly deconstruct it and expand it, to open our range of possibilities. Now, one of the interesting kind of things you get in Hebrew tradition is this, and in the book of Genesis, you get this idea of Adam. The human being is called Adam. Now, and so in a certain sense, Adam is a human being, right? And we have this image of Adam, human being. But in the Hebrew scriptures, they add another word to it, Adama. They put the letter He at the end, which means the ground. And Adam is the human being coming out of the ground. Now, the whole point about ground is that it is the fertile, ground is the place from which all the forms come, all the plants come out of the ground. And therefore all life comes out of the ground. So the other thing that's said about human beings is that they are made in the image of the divine. Now, and that image, the deeper aspect of that image, and that image gets very translated in Orthodox religion to being a good, godly person. Be a godly person, which is a perverted image, actually. To be a godly person, a good person, is to split the world. Right? It's an image of obedience and obedience to authority. But the deeper image is to be the ground out of which all possible forms can arise. All possibilities of creativity can arise. To be the ground from which a disco ball arises, right? Now, if we track the disco ball, which is interesting, so there's a sort of attraction to the disco ball, midlife thing, and what emerges is something much bigger. So you might have had an image of the disco ball in the corner of your room at home, but actually something big emerges. And so it's an expression of size, bigness, power, potency. And then an expression of, oh my God, I don't know what to do with this. So I'm going to have to sit with this and find a way to be with this form I have given birth to. Which then travels into Purple Square HQ, another form you've given birth to. That then creates this exotic, powerful, quirky, it'll do lots of things, that ball, right? But it's an expression. You see, that's an expression of deep creativity. You know, the trouble is when we use these words, we sound like, you have to be very pious, but they're not. I mean, the disco ball is this actually secret, irreverent object brings in the, sort of, John Travolta into the room, the god John Travolta. Stayed alive. brings in the gesture. For those of us who know, those who are initiates in the cult of the great god John Travolta. Staying alive. Dude. Staying alive.
It's the Sistine Chapel.
It is the Sistine Chapel.
It's wonderful. And it's a magician in the tarot.
It can be that as well. It can be. Well then, just look at that, and you just have to look at his hips. This is a man who can move. Remember all that? Yeah.
You can say the nightclub, the dance, the glitter, yeah. Is the temple.
Totally you can.
It's exactly the same.
Absolutely the same thing, right? That's the whole thing. But of course what we do with life is we divide it up into sacred, profane, kind of, and therefore we narrow ourselves. We shut ourselves in. And the problem, and the universal problem we're working with in this course and all this kind of work, is how to keep on breaking out of the box. And how to trust that deeper kind of energy and let it come in and bring that power of life, that power of new possibility in with it. But it involves really that it involves a sort of a breaking out of old images and trusting the new expressions all the time, and looking at how we and other people separate ourselves by the clinging to old images. Now, one of the big problems in our world, universal problems, is the clinging to old images. You know, and a lot of the really disturbing things that you can see happening in the world is the clinging to images of nationhood, clinging to, the sort of sometimes religious images are appalling in the world at the moment. Actually, whether it's Islam or whether it's Christianity. You know, there's a real kind of resurgence of old religious imagery. You know, and with all the concomitant racism and separation that comes with it. So a lot of the work that we look at in this is how to transform old images. How to deal with disturbance. How to deal with disturbed imagery that is imagery of separation. you know, the anti-Islamic kind of energy that's around, you know, the the crusading imagery, you know, the kind of the anti, the homophobic images that are, you know, the kind of, and I mean the Alabama, the prospective senator for Alabama, who is to the right of Donald Trump, because the Donald Trump candidate wasn't extreme enough, is riding around as a fake cowboy. He's not a cowboy really, but he's riding around as a cowboy with guns. And has swept the Republican candidate away, the official Republican candidate, and you see these old, you know, so you find that old image of the cowboy, an American, very powerful American image, riding into center stage and kind of and with all the, you know, in the same way that here we have images of the fucking British Empire arising all the bloody time. You know, there was a debate about Brexit and people talking about the greatness of Britain and walking away, you know, and you think, and these are people in the thrall of images, that are old images of imperialism in some ways.
Is this a world of shells?
Yes, it is a world of shells in that level. Johnny,
it's just that there's two opposites colliding,
yep,
to my mind. Mm. Yes, they're old images,
yep,
that are used, but they're recreated,
yes,
constantly.
Totally, yeah.
The, you might say the extreme right,
yeah,
far more creative with the image, the story, the,
yes,
gut,
they are,
feeling.
That's right, yeah.
The extreme left are very boring,
yeah,
because they appeal to reason and logic and principle, which goes over most people's heads.
Yeah.
The image and the word are viscerally understood,
yeah, that's right,
by the fascist.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're good at.
Yeah, that's right.
You see the Nazi rallies,
yeah,
replicated over and over.
Yeah.
It's a very creative energy.
Yeah.
However much you dislike it. But there is a creativity there.
Yeah, totally. No, that's right, and that's why you see it's the that's why we, and that's the problem with if we just stick with body of reason, you're with the body of flesh alone, right? In some ways, you're with that formed. So the is that in, if you bring in the sort of, if you like potential to dream, the potential for imagery, and you put that into forms that have clarity. So you bring together clarity and that dreaming kind of potential. Now that's when you create vision, that's an embodied vision that affects people. I mean, you're doing it in Purple Square HQ, right? You're creating a form that has a quirky, creative, interesting energy. It's already doing stuff like, you know, like the kind of town planner, town guy, and the Hinckley people. You can see it's already starting to attract quirky energy, because it's a potentized form. So whatever we put out in our life with word and image, we create, and it's what poems are like this as well, they create a structure, but they also have this energetic, imaginative dimension that then start to have effect in the world, that start to embody things. You see it in a dance performance, you see it in a piece of writing, you know, certainly creating an artwork. You have to bring together the technicality of the form with the image, so that the two come together, and that coming together is that creative impulse which affects the world. Now we're doing this all the time, because we're all the time working with our images and working on the sense of self and sense of world. But what we're going to look at in particular, really, over these next few weekends, is really looking at how we do that consciously and what happens when we do. What happens when we consciously really align with our deep, still place, and then trust the impulse that arises there, and let that come into sort of breathing, sort of living, solid image. An image which will change, of course, but actually it's, and that in a way is what this business of bringing together the body of flesh with the body of dream together, so that the mysterious place, the deeper place, then can focus its energies, through something that as, that is both solid and fluid, as Rob was talking about granite, that image of granite as a something that can be fluid and is also kind of solid, and in a way in granite's case quite crystalline, so very focused. So it means we're working with opposites, because we're working with that, because the dreaming potential, you have to sort of relax, you have to come out, you have to kind of allow this possibility. But you can't leave it there. Now, one of the problems always that a lot of people have, are quite good at dreaming, is it doesn't get anywhere. Right? Because actually it stays at that level of dream and slight dissociation. Similarly, if you are not connected to the idea of dreaming at all, you're stuck with repeating the known, because there's no new potential coming through. But when you do the difficult thing of just putting together that sense of the deep imagination with that sense of form and structure and focus, then something else starts to happen. Then you get the creation of icons, and in fact you yourself then become an icon. You become the kind of the living vessel for the mysterious light, for the mystery. And that iconic form is constantly changing. The form that is you is constantly changing. So it's constantly returning into stillness, constantly recreating itself. Now, in that actual attempt to be that, we of course come up against the places that are, and the structures that we've got going on that don't want to do that. They don't want to dissolve. Because unfortunately, just because of how we are, we have all these little closed loops going on in ourselves, which want to stay as they are. And are self-referential, are looking inwards to their own content. You know, so the part of me that doesn't like stupid people. It's horrible, I hate admitting, but no, I hate stupid people. Me.
Oh.
Yeah, I hate stupid people. I get very frustrated and angry. And some parts of me want some people on bicycles, but not everybody on a bicycle. It's people on thin, tall blokes wearing lycra on bicycles, who ride abreast.
Yeah.
They should die.
Middle-aged men
in lycra, mammals. That's right. Mammals, exactly. That's right. They should all die. I'm joking about it, but part of me wants that, right? I mean, that's the horrible bit is, that's a really joke, part of me, they would think, yeah, that's fair, it's fair enough to me, they should all die. I would like them not to exist on the planet. And if I could drive for the rest of my life with never seeing one of those, I'd be thinking, good. It's true. And that's kind of the problem in some ways, right? Because, of course, I want to destroy some part of the world. I can't, so whatever the potential, I can't. Fucking possibly imagine what potential goodness can be for me in that, right? Except, of course, I have a relationship with a bloody exercise bike, so I'm edging in that direction despite myself. But the problem is I do close up on one possibility, just a small one. I'm not going to worry too much about that one, to be honest. But that is the problem with these kind of loops, okay? They just don't want to dissolve. So the idea that I could dissolve and arise as a bloke in lycra with a sporty bike, that's a potential of life that is denied to me. What a shame. But that is the sort of problem, okay? Because so that instead of being able just to dissolve and then allow whatever needs to arise, we are limited in that because we've got these forms that block possibility. Now that's the thing I keep calling an idol. Right, that stops that potential of light. So instead of all possibilities arising, you get these great images of the Bodhisattva Mavikoliteshvara in Buddhism, which is this extraordinary form that has these 11 heads and 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes coming out of it. And in a way, that's a way of trying to depict in bronze the true form of the human being, the true creative form, where you can look in all kinds of different ways and at different levels, because these heads go up, so you can experience life at all kinds of different levels, look in all kinds of different directions, And then you have this wonderful image of the hand with an eye in it. So you touch the world with awareness. And there's at least a thousand, and the idea of it is infinite, really, an infinite ways of touching the world at any one time. Now, of course, if you were caught in 1,000 hands around, you'd fall over a lot and you wouldn't be able to coordinate them. So it isn't really that you'd have 1,000 hands, but any possible hand could come out in relationship to what is needed. So sometimes the hand holds a flower, sometimes it holds a sword, sometimes it embraces, sometimes it punches in the gut. Right. So it's that, and in a way it's saying that this is the deep potential of a human being. Because the human being is the mediator between the formed world and the mischievous ground. And so when you see people like the Buddha, people like Jesus, these big iconic people, they are people who do not resist the capacity of the deep capacity of life and allow it to form them in whatever way. So they're living on that edge, of allowing the light through without reservation. Now, in order to do that, they have to keep on dissolving, keep on letting go of the previous form.
Is that why? Because, like, for me, I find it very hard to have a strong opinion on anything.
Yeah, of course.
I haven't got any strong views.
Yeah, because if you had a very fixed view, right, if you had really fixed views, you would be stuck in a shape. Right? But what you will find happen is that you will have a view that will arise in relationship to a set of circumstances. But the next time, those circumstances will have shifted, so your view will have shifted. Mm. Totally. That's because actually you're in touch with something, and if you had this is what I believe, right? And if you look at people with incredibly strong beliefs, you know, they can be passionate and they can be interesting, but what they have to do is they narrow their range of expression profoundly. And sometimes people catch an energy of life, and that works in them, and that. But they're often like a bit fanatical. They do one thing. And there's always a shadow side to that kind of image. Right, whereas actually what we're looking for here is not that, it's actually that kind of fluidity that can work with changing circumstances. I think you can see it in Jeremy Corbyn to some extent, actually. He's catching an energy, and there's some brilliant things about Jeremy Corbyn, but I also think there are, and this is just my opinion, I think there's a real shadow side to him, where he's stuck in that old left-wing kind of image that I remember from the 70s, And I was watching him talking to John Snow, was challenging him, and he got really and he was doing really well, and then he got really pissed off with him and really kind of aggressive, and actually he sort of blew it, because somewhere there's that kind of that's like what I perceived anyway as a controlling kind of shape somewhere that is in the old left that cannot tolerate dissension. And for a moment, I mean, that's just my opinion, obviously, for a moment I think I saw that. Whereas actually, had he not done that, if he had relaxed a bit and even been kind of welcoming of the criticism and curious, he'd have been much more effective in that moment. He'd have embraced, but he couldn't do it. He was just, there's just rigidity meeting that kind of meeting inquiry.
So it can be a bit subtler as well, I know for myself, but I can think of examples through a friend. He obviously had a very profound sense of gratitude on a retreat.
Yeah.
It really meant, obviously, what you meant a huge amount to him, but he's been going on about gratitude for the last 4 years, and it's become dead ever since.
It's been dead, right? So that became something that was an icon for a moment, right? That allowed something living through, then closes up. Then it becomes a bloody heavy old idol he's just carrying around, pissing everybody off, probably.
And he's not open to anything?
No, it's that's right, it stops something else happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like you have something like the gratitude, your friend, and then you have to let it go.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, oh, but I love this so much.
No, that's right.
Oh,
that's right.
Barren.
Yes, it's hard, isn't it?
Back to nothing.
And now I'm back to nothing. And that's the thing, right? Because actually, in order to let it go, you go back to that nothing place. That's hard, because you're sort of letting, you know, because then it's very exposed and you don't know if anything else is going to come. So, so that's always the difficulty, isn't it?
There's one thing I find in writing. I use particular forms like from Japanese poetry, the haiku, which is very structured.
Yeah, right. Yep.
And I use the same structure again and again and again and again.
Yep.
And I try to do it each time in a different way, so that it reconstructs the given construction.
Yes.
I keep to the very disciplined mode.
Yep.
Try and subvert it and reinvent it.
Yeah, and that's the place then where form and dream come together, right? So that's the so I'm not saying this that we shouldn't have any forms. I mean, that's a good example. Actually, the haiku thing is a good example. It's a whole genre that's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. That and yet each haiku is unique, even though it's got its particular shape. So it isn't that we become chaotic and don't work with shape. Sometimes the very shape itself imposes a discipline. That deepens the creative idea. It's a bit like Pauline and I were talking about people doing pencil drawings. Mm-hmm. Right now, that's that's a pencil drawing up there, and I've got others in my book. Now, there's a sort of you create a particular shape where you're not going to use colour. You're just going to use shades of grey and black and white. So that and so it isn't that you're rejecting form, you use that form. That form then becomes the sort of the focusing point and that allows the creativity to come through. And there is this kind of mysterious coming together of form and creativity that then enables something new to arise. So that the whole business of body of flesh, which is a body of flesh, body of dream, which then creates a sort of a lens and a door, right? So there's a field of focus then starts to happen, which enables something to happen that otherwise wouldn't.
So are you talking about, like, you have a medium, like the pencil?
Yeah.
You have a medium to do for the haiku, you have a medium.
Yeah.
And you travel on that road.
Yeah.
What the dream will bring you.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yes, exactly. So you let that be the thing that helps the expression, confines the expression. Right. But the difference is that you're consciously working with form and creativity here, right? So it's a conscious choice. John isn't writing haiku because he thinks that all other kinds of poetry is shit. Right. So if John were writing haiku because he's identified with Japanese tradition and all Western poetry is rubbish apart from haiku, you know, it'd be like an unconscious pattern driving it. So pretty much the creativity would diminish in that. But choosing the haiku form because it sharpens your creative instincts, because it's a conscious living choice. Right, so it's a bit like you buy a disco ball, right? So you buy this. That's a powerful form. So, right. So there's an attraction to a form, haiku or a disco ball. Now, if you're kind of lost in the image, so you could be lost in the image of I want to go back to the 80s. I want the ball in my house. I think about how many walls, you know, I'm going to have to knock a wall down. So one of the things, so if Becky got lost in the kind of image of the ball and recreating the 80s in her own house, so she has to knock a wall down, and she and Alex will have to negotiate quite fiercely probably about the knocking of the wall down. And eventually I knock a wall down and I kind of, okay, and I've got the 80s, but now my kitchen's buggered up or whatever else is destroyed. But somehow that could be, if you like, an unconscious image. Instead of being iconic, it becomes this fucking great idol that sits in your house and because you don't have to use it. See, if you set it up, you'd have to do disco regularly in your house. Get on down. Which would be fun, of course, but you know, but would seal out other things. But having got the form, right now, that's the interesting thing. You say, oh, no, fuck, I'm gonna do this. So then I have to work with the form, right? So whether it's a haiku or whether it's a disco ball, you work then with that form consciously. You have to be present with it. You have to kind of, which involves not talking about Alex about it at this point, because actually you've got nothing to say. There's nothing enough to sit with the effect of it being there, it being in your life. And then something shifts. Just like, I'm going to write a haiku, I'm not going to write something, I'm going to keep to that form, I'm going to stay with it, and then something arises. So the creative use is made of the form.
Yeah. a language like perhaps like you have a, so Rick is bored. It might be an intuitive moment of, do you know something, that ball is really speaking to me. That ball is in my life somewhere.
Yeah.
I guess. And then you say, well, I know it's in my life. I'm not sure where I go to place it because, well, I thought I'd like to have it. Isn't it right?
Yeah.
I'm just going to see what comes. Oh, it's upstairs and
yeah.
in the box, etc. But is there something about...
It's a conscious... It's an aware process, right? The whole thing is an aware process in this.
Well, we're back to the linear thinking doesn't work.
Yeah, totally.
Because it never does.
No, it never does.
What kind of throw something in here?
Go on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can I just throw money into this?
Yeah, go on.
Because for me, what I'm noticing is, you know, wonderful. Now, I love what Fern has done for last year, you know, and that whole, when you have money that can support you to have time to
yeah.
be expansive, to come up with these great ideas.
Yeah.
What I'm noticing, what my colleague Barney is, the moment you put money into the equation, so we've got to earn a decent living,
yeah.
we've got to charge for our services,
yeah.
something changes. That creative process.
So what changes though in that
bit? Well, I don't want it to change anything, but it does. It seems to stop the fluidity of how that then emerges.
Well, the interesting thing, we need to finish because we go for lunch, but
yeah.
the thing is this, right, we'll come back to this, but I just wanted to answer it because it's an important point. Because actually money there is like the haiku. It's like the form, right? So how do we work creatively with money? With the need to earn money.
Oh, you do it that way around, do you? See, I wouldn't do it that way around.
What way around would you do, Annie?
Well, if you find something you love to do,
yeah.
then you go, I've got to make a living. How can...
Yeah, that's another way to do it, yeah. yeah.
How can I do it? How can money going to come through
yeah,
so
that's
that
right.
I can
yeah.
do what my heart's calling me to do?
Yeah, that's the same, yes, just a different way of describing it. Because what you have to do is to put the money together, not push the money away. You have to put together that need with money with the vision, with the thing, right? And you have to hold those things together so that, and this is a business of bringing the two things together, so that something starts to happen in that middle place. You know, in my own case, just to finish on this, really. So when I was pig sick of working for the government, but you know, I had to work. Well, how can I make a living being a psychotherapist? You know, it's not a very well paid profession, and kind of. And I had a lot of, partly because of my previous spending habits, I had a certain amount of money I had to kind of support. Certain amount of income I needed to generate, because I'd seen some of my friends like to, you know, downscale and not earn very much. Really in a position to do that, nor did I want to do that either, to be honest, right? Because actually I quite enjoy buying things. I enjoy cars, you know. So for me, to do that, I had to think, well, how can I do that and still have a nice car and still enjoy my drink and enjoy buying whatever I fancy buying. So that's what I had to kind of deal with. And so it took me on a journey. That kind of, you know, and fortunately earned very well. But that's kind of what you have to do. You have to kind of do that. But of course, there's a whole process of dealing with all the stuff that comes up when you do that. Money is such a powerful, amazing thing, really, because it leads us into very, very early material inside ourselves. But the point about it is you have to, one of the splits in our culture is that the between creativity and money. The starving artist image is a very, very big collective image in our culture. Don't expect to earn money if you're an artist. Right? It's a big deal. So if you're doing something creative, you know, don't expect to earn good money out of it. It's a big, big, big thing. So if you're in the place of wanting to do something creative and needing and wanting money, then you're in a countercultural position. And then you have to sit with that and try and trust what happens. I mean, just literally we'll finish on this because we need to go for lunch. In my own journey, right, so I had this linear journey worked out around psychotherapy. where I was going to, you know, I would start seeing clients. I see clients in the evening and on top of my work, because that could keep my money up. Then I was going to go part-time and then I had this rational process about how I'd keep my income going and gradually transfer myself over. And I did start to do that until the year 2000, when my friend Kitasaro offered me the opportunity to go sit on a mountain for 5 months in South Africa. This is the moment where I was leaving the government service. And so what I did, because it felt right, and Ali and I talked about it, and we did a whole working out money bits around it to some extent. So I then completely left my job and closed my practice down for 6 months and went off and sat on a mountain in South Africa. And with the linear part of me screaming at me, but the deeper part of me thinking I'm going to do this because I'm year 2000, and I always wondered what will I be doing in the year 2000, because and I'm 45, year 2000, and I really liked the idea of sitting on a mountain and chucking everything up in the air and seeing what happened. And actually it worked. I didn't know it was going to work when I came back. I didn't know if anyone would come back and see me, because people weren't thrilled that I just thought, oh, tough, I'm off and sit on a mountain. But it worked. And that's the thing about this. If you engage with this, it is unpredictable. So it cannot be linear. It involves linearity. It involves linear thinking as well. So it isn't it is this literal fusion between the linear and the non-linear. And then having to trust the mysterious process. I'll just stop there because we need to go for our lunch.